Next, it's my pleasure to introduce my colleagues, Dana Kapkova and Kevin Pratt, who together co-founded and are principals of Epiphyte Lab, an architectural research and design collaborative. Specifically, Dana Kapkova, in her current academic research, is focused on ecologically adaptive component systems and their cultural and socio-political effects. Her work focuses on embedding methods of contemporary fabrication technology and discrete energy harvesting systems into architectural design through a better understanding of computationally generated geometry and its responsiveness to particular climatic conditions, and has been supported by the Architectural Foundation's Arnold W. Brunner Grant Award and Cornell University Faculty Innovation and Teaching. Since 2001, Kapkova has directed DCM Studio in architectural design practice. She received her diploma in architecture from the Faculty of Architecture and Urban Design at the Slavic Technical University in Bratislava, and an MArch II from the School of Arts and Architecture at UCLA, where she was awarded the unrestricted university fellowship. Kevin Pratt is a registered architect in the state of New York and has 13 years' experience as a researcher and designer, and is also a principal of Epiphyte, as I mentioned previously. He is an expert in the use of computational technologies and their application to the process of sustainable design. In addition to Cornell University, he has taught at Pratt and has been a visiting critic and lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. He received his bachelor's in architecture from Columbia University and an MA from the Environment and Energy Program at the Architectural Association in London. Please join me in welcoming both Kevin and Dana.
Hello?
Is
yours working? Try yours.
I think we're both good. Hello, thank you for having us. We scripted our talk a little bit in an effort not to cut each other off, because we do tend to do that. So we're going to be in a context of a conference talking about one specific project with a little bit of framework, an introduction of a sort of a general way of how we work together. So Epiphyte Lab, so you all know Epiphyte is a plant that grows opportunistically on other plants. It is a non-parasitic plant, and it creates local microecologies embedded within larger pre-existing systems and creates new conditions. Parallel to that, our work as Epiphyte Lab engages built environment at the intersection of ecology, computational driven processes, and systems analysis. I think I don't know how to drive. I do. Okay, good. So we experiment with methods of design in attempt to embed natural systems in the complexity of their ecological and cultural context by tying together a series of iterative feedback loops that link environmental data, formal systems, and fabrication logics. In the center of our work is understanding and defining the context for an architectural project before imagining the project itself. The disciplinary notion of architectural site systemically resists the necessity to respond and adapt to specific environments from the biosynergetic point of view, and the need to place ecology to the core of political and socioeconomic issues. The disciplinary definition of context generally is reduced to an abstraction of the site condition, rendered as a culturally constructed understanding of the ground or as an infinitely occupiable surface, rather than a component in a series of nested complex systems embedded into particular dynamic patterns of energy, information, and cultural exchange. In effect, we argue for a specific hierarchy for constructing the cultural through an understanding of an ecological, while abandoning the idea of a fixed place in favor of indeterminate and spatially concurrent places.
So The sort of question I think that we start to ask is why would we want to do this, or why are more traditional methods of design seeming increasingly inadequate in the face of this complexity and scale of the contemporary inhabitation of the biosphere? And I think this slide is interesting because it talks about ideas in ecology about energy flows through what are considered sort of juvenile systems and more stable and more sort of complexified mature systems. And an example might be the difference between a rainforest ecosystem where solar energy is processed and bound into a highly diverse biosynthesis, and a cornfield where the solar energy is transformed into carbohydrates in corn kernels that are easily harvested but require energy input in the form of fertilizers and the like to survive. And so our kind of insight is that this sort of prevailing neoliberal systems of economic and cultural organization tend to create cornfields. They tend to be organized to maximize extractable, in the economic sense of the word, rents. And what we're interested in doing is thinking of ways to reorganize these systems as rainforests to increase both throughput and feedback for the benefit of the system itself, making it more diverse, resilient, and democratic, and to make it serve actual communities, human and otherwise, as opposed to some abstract sort of econo-bureaucratic system of commodification and exchange. And we want to, this reorganization in general has to be spatial, it has to be material, it has to be ecological, and it has to be systemic and pervasive. So simply inserting, and we always hear this term in architecture and I hate it, we insert things. Inserting is not enough. We have to recognize that we always operate inside of existing hierarchically organized systems. And so we have to do away, I think, with this idea of this kind of dichotomy that we hear about in architecture of new construction versus adaptive reuse, and realize that in a very real sense, every project is adaptive, just adaptive, and in a sense, it's about reimagining patterns of material, cultural, and energetic exchange. And I just want to show this in sort of two examples that relate to our project. The first is the idea, our project is called the Green Negligee, but this is the idea of the emerald necklace, right? And the emerald necklace, of course, developed by Olmsted as a way of introducing nature in a kind of some form back into the developing city of Boston in the 19th century. And the necklace is always pure and distinct. It's a kind of artificially constructed ornament of sort of a second nature that is experienced as an exclusion of the city. Whereas I think what we're interested in is this idea of the negligee as an infused overlay, always revealing the nature of the body to different degrees. There is no attempt to reconstruct the nature, but rather to tap into the systemic character of the body and bodily functions in a specific context to produce new conditions. And so the project for Green Negligee wants to address the environmental and social problems of essentially what we're looking at is Soviet-era panelized housing blocks and how they are transitioning or not transitioning to the current neoliberal globalized economy. And the purpose of this investigation was to leverage the embedded and yet currently suppressed social desire for collective cultivation and leisure and the political, economic, and ad hoc land use patterns that have developed since the fall of communism in Bratislava to create a system that can engender a sustainable approach to the reuse of these sort of housing blocks in this sort of post-Soviet world.
Just a little bit of a history of a concept. Can you hear me? Oh. Can you hear me?
Your battery's, oh, very good.
There. Okay, sorry. So a little bit of a context for the project. It was constructed in the 60s and 70s across the city center as a totalitarian parallel to modernist model of a functional city. And this area is called Petržalka. It's about 200,000, has 200,000 occupants. It's an example of a sort of suburban community, top-down state control planning process that resulted in rigid programmatic segregation and a figure-ground compositional scheme dominated by the application of a panelized prefabricated concrete system while serving particular social engineering agenda. This organizational model prioritized collective distribution of the utility systems over any notion of individual control. And what's interesting, since the fall of communism, all the apartment blocks have been privatized. But this new ownership model has created many ambiguities about the extent of the actual ownership beyond the line of the single apartment. Collective spaces, the ambiguity of ownership of collective spaces, and especially energy management. So regardless of the fact that the basic building typology allows for very little variation or adaptability, there all the ad hoc reconfiguration and reprogramming are constantly in flux. So the sort of a tension between individual versus collective, it's quite critical. Also, privatization has led to questionable ownership of auxiliary system, neglect, and maintenance problems, as well as imposing on residents the human costs of living in fundamentally unsustainable buildings. However, despite the stigma usually attached to this kind of social housing, the real estate itself became quite valuable due to its proximity to the city center and shift in post-Soviet demographics, and especially the EU's effort to partially fund what's called the beautification of the facades, which is a collective surface insulation of uninsulated panelized blocks. However, the issue of landscape use and ownership remains problematic. Historically, the district was used for viticulture. During the era of collective ownership, the strong cultural need to transform the ground within the stark figure of the rectilinear plan was channeled into cultivation, planting, and gardening. And the building owned the land around it. It took care of it. The garden ownership occurred by nature, by nurture, really, and perhaps by local dispute. But it was kind of always happening. In the post-Soviet era, this desire has been suppressed by the loss of coherent ownership of public spaces. Thus, because of the general deterioration of the collective, nature and is reasserting itself. Every crack is overgrown and filled with weeds, new sort of ecosystems and ecologies. And as a result, the figure ground is dissolving, adding textural and spatial complexities and new ecosystem. This is where we kind of took our inspirations from, as the sort of a notion of the anthropocentric understanding of the weeds, which we have heard questioned before. And what the green negligee attempts to do is to dissolve the figure ground by blurring the hard boundary between the buildings and the landscape with a lightweight secondary membrane, while creating a new semi-tempered spaces that also host a variety of low-maintenance quasi-naturalistic systems, energy harvesting devices, other species that in their aggregation create an alternatives to installed building service systems and contribute to a new character of the landscape. This dissolved zone would bind the disjoint and atomized physical spaces of the existing blocks into semi-autonomous habitats and nest into the larger pre-existing ecological systems and help evolve their identity. It would define the district as a whole while constructing a new ground and partial semi-permeable enveloping system. But how do we do this?
So, given our sort of desire to integrate the ecologically and socially pre-existing, the first step was we really tried to develop, to understand the dynamic environment that exists currently on the site, and to do this through the creation of sort of layered dynamic maps that could function sort of virtually as a kind of test bed to evaluate modes of intervention. And we constructed these test beds by aggregating existing site information in four-dimensional digital models, while running various kinds of simulations on the model to deduce the existence of conditions that would eventually influence intervention. And let's see if you can see the... Okay. And so you can see here some of the kind of figure ground of Petrozhalka, this kind of enormous district. And the other thing that's critical about it is that it's sitting in the old Danube riverbed, so it's also sort of implanted on top of this incredible riverine kind of ecology, which has been somewhat managed through the traditional methods of like canals and things like that. But looking at this whole process, we sort of had a few key insights. You know, the first one is that the collapse of the top-down authority has atomized ownership, and that pressures from the transition to the market-based economy has created all these ad hoc decision-making structures at the scale of the building, as well as all this localized, uncoordinated reprogramming, meaning that efforts that require any kind of sort of coordination above the very individual scale are really impractical. Two, that the local population is reorganizing at the local scale to oppose the co-option of public space by external market forces, i.e. like Walmart, literally. But they lack any kind of physical mechanism to affect any kind of change, right? So they don't have a physical mechanism to deal with this problem. And three, that the existing service systems for the buildings to support the people who live there are inadequate and almost completely dependent on off-site sources and sinks to generate energy, dispose of waste, meaning that the local ecosystem services, ironically, are almost completely untapped in this location. And also that the physical layout of the buildings and the landscape in interaction with climatic and hydrological forces create multiple overlapping zones for opportunistic intervention, which reveal themselves through these dynamic mapping processes. In other words, there exists between the sort of figure and ground, this sort of Siam modernist figure ground, this third zone, which is defined by wind, sun, water, plants, other agencies, and is uncaptured by the existing modes of bureaucratic control. And what we sort of realize there, both culturally and sort of ecophysically, there is essentially an unoccupied or unoccupied niche. And this is a sample of sort of these hybrid environmental mapping techniques we've used to discover these landscapes of climate and site. And these invisible boundary conditions define niches where componentized energy, waste processing systems, more or less functional systems could be developed and deployed. And the goal is to define zones of overlap and gradients where viticulture, wind harvesting, gray water filtration, all these kinds of things might be effective. And this is a sort of diagram showing some initial thoughts on how we might integrate these multiple systems to create both closed resource loops and sort of new public spaces for leisure. And I think it's worth noting here that one of the things about the cultural analysis that's really critical is that in Bratislava, there's a very strong desire for collective leisure, which we don't have here. So like this system probably wouldn't work here. It wouldn't work in Harlem, even though the building type might look similar, because there isn't that kind of sort of social memory of these collective Soviet era and pre-Soviet era idea of collective leisure, which I think is interesting.
So given that axiomatically nature abhors a vacuum, we design a system to fill this niche. Using the dynamic digital map as a base model, we have proposed a hierarchical system of parts that can be implemented at the sub-building scale and be aggregated to interlock both with the larger build environment and the existing landscape. The primary component of the system forms the tensile networks that create secondary surface between the ground and the facade and host for the functional systems that produce spatial effects and systemic integration. It also enables a new form of landscape distribution, subdivision of the ownership of this landscape, as well as the habitats, hopefully the habitats for other species. The components hosted by the net aggregate, they aggregate into the larger overlapping systems. This is sort of a diagram of distributions and system connectivity. They tend to organize themselves sectionally and spread horizontally to define space. An example of these are the VibroWind power devices, and we've been working closely with some of the new research in engineering and bioengineering here to tap into some of these discrete harvesting system, which can be incorporated into the and redistributed over the surfaces rather than be separate from the notion of architectural space. So the wind power devices are taking advantage of the prevailing winds. The power existing building system and devices like lights and pumps that are part of the network. Glass shingles of different types can congregate near to the vertical surface of the network and near the facade to form a secondary system of enclosure to both shade and trap the solar radiation. Mixture of trellis and planter components occurring where the network turns horizontal and which capture both a runoff of gray water, host grape vines that allow for localized viticulture and create semi-enclosed public space. The component network is married to a landscape that has been reconfigured using berms, swales, and gabions to both reinforce the attributes of a public space created and further store and process runoff water after descending from the component patchwork. The components organized sectionally, and this is just a kind of a idealized sectional diagrams were layered with all the sort of a data sets which we considered important, and it shows the relationship between the environmental conditions, net formations, and component distribution. The main cable net is of the facade also serves as a graywater filtration system. There's a kind of a pre-filtration cattail basins on our roof. And so it's a graywater filtration medium, which is based on an NFT, the nutrient film technique for hydroponic plant growth developed by William Jewell here at Cornell. So once we understand the effective niches for distributions of the components, we studied structuring and relaxation of the lightweight surfaces and potential pattern logic for distributing these systems across them with the specific variables. In this case, the vibrowind, which are the funnels, funnel component, are distributed according to wind speed zones and direction. And the trellis pattern has kind of a tendency to target the area with the greater solar insolation. We simultaneously work at two scales, developing the full-scale component prototypes. In this case, this is the close-up of the vibrowind system, which is a discrete wind power system that uses vibration instead of rotation to generate power. It consists of concentrators, the funnels, and oscillators, which are the series of the small kinetic elements you see on your left in the bottom corner. The idea of kind of studying the formal effects of the concentrators within the larger distributed network was where this was tested in the two scales. In the effort to create a sort of a hybrid space, we tried to further develop other hybrid analytical model. This is a digital data map with environmental data feedback of the potential component distribution on tensile network. And what this image shows is, or actually how it was created, was by taking the three-dimensional data fields containing both the wind speeds and solar radiation, and then passing the interpolated data at mesh vertices through the probability matrix to identify where different types of components are more or less likely to function well. Yellow zones are areas of high wind and solar radiation. The red zones are low wind and high solar radiations, and blue zones areas are both low wind and radiation. So the idea of a specificity here is very loose. There is no perfect solution. There is this kind of a probability zone overlap, which also is linked to the form generation of the net itself, where the form of the net is developed using relaxation algorithm, and it's applied to the boundary conditions between the areas of the relative environmental and programmatic differentiation revealed by the digital map of the site. So given that in any defined zone, there is a multiplicity of these conditions, and a multiplicity of these boundaries exist. So between the areas of lesser and greater turbulence, available radiation, existing view corridors, etc. So the net here serves as kind of a loose fit. It's very much of a kind of a setting for this patchwork of system within the notion of a loose fit and idea of kind of the anti-hyper-specificity of this kind of a plastic construction. So particular surfaces and different subdivision patterns can be selected to create terrains that are more or less suited to different purposes, to form enclosures, private winter gardens, semi-enclosed public spaces, to be hosts for localized viticulture and other water purifying horticulture, to support localized energy generating devices.
So I think the important thing to understand is that this configuration that you see is not so much represent a design, right, which you would repeat ad infinitum across a larger site, but a sort of particular scenario that might fit a localized set of conditions and intents. And the process is sort of about making best guesses or even creating systems in such a way that the people who actually occupy the spaces can sort of make best guesses at configurations suitable to a particular locale. And so it's really about making a series of choices at each level of the system hierarchy from a set of kind of fuzzy potentialities delineated by overlapped sets of analytical and observational data that emerge from this kind of indeterminate analysis. And the other thing is the hierarchical organization and loose fit between systemic levels allows for a localized specificity that enables the system to scale all the way down to the human dimension and be reconfigured over time. So the important thing to think about this is that The nets themselves are fairly loose and lightweight in terms of actual material. This is sort of out of Fryado. That the buildings themselves are massively, massively overstructured, so they're more than able to deal with these tensile networks. And so one thing to imagine with these things is imagine, for example, if a fairly large horizontal area of the cable net has been populated with trellis and planter components, creating an overhead garden or this sort of viticulture, which comes from, you saw the picture, they're already doing this. But in the future, you know, a section of that public space under the system could easily be converted to a playground, and the patch of network above it can be covered with glass shingle, either in place of or above the plants, to form a pavilion of sorts. It makes it easy for, say, like children to play in the rain. And, you know, the thing is that this sounds like a super prosaic kind of dumb thing, but actually we think that it's out of the sort of quotidian adaptability through everyday life that we're actually going to achieve something that's actually sustainable, as opposed to these sort of hyper-engineered solutions and the loose fit. Right, it's the loose fit is really critical. I think this gets into this idea of this sort of thick malleable boundary that some other people have been talking about. And it also was about this balancing the needs of the collective and the individual. So this is a sort of image of what it starts to look like in the winter as sort of seasonally adapted, but also that the facade system can essentially adapt and create private systems or reconfigure this sort of balcony boundary area, right? This is not a sealed system. For localized individuals, but also start to create a kind of public space, and also create, I think, sort of also critically, this kind of idea of hosting other species. And we kind of like to think about some of these devices, like the wind power devices or other things, as actually being sort of mechanical species in a way, in the same way that you can imagine birds and other things. And the same thing with the landscape, which tries to get rid of all the parking, which is all paved now, and reintroduce this kind of almost marsh system that existed there previously. We also were curious about, you know, as we designed these systems, like what the heck would they actually do to buildings? So this is an example of work that I do in conjunction with Don Greenberg. And actually, these images were processed by Mike, who's sitting out in the audience, looking at sort of some advanced simulation techniques to try and deal with trying to understand the effects of these kind of complex networks on actual buildings through thermal simulation and other kinds of simulation. So, and one of the things that's interesting about it is that one of the effects of this network is that it actually has an effect of cooling the building. So in other words, it actually increases some of the heating requirements in the winter because it shades it, but it reduces the cooling effects. But interestingly enough, if you look at the projections for global warming, right now Bratislava has quite a bit of heating, but it looks like that's changing fairly quickly. And so in a sense, it also becomes a method of sort of anticipatory control of potential changes to the environment. And it's kind of critical to us that the methods by which we define these strategies exist on multiple nested and interlinked scales, and that the notion of energy capital and power usage, as well as a desire for material effects in the support of social systems, demonstrate a different approach to using ecology to anticipate this architecture that is, within a certain lifespan, tightly bound to the specificity of place, yet not hyperspecific in and of itself. It anticipates the need for a system of parts having the ability to dynamically transform both during the process of design and construction and throughout a functional lifespan. And it inspires us to rethink architectural material and its componentization in a more complex way. And it suggests this need for sort of biomimetic strategies, using biomimetic process, you know, not for the creation of formal analogy, but to develop an understanding of performance, system logic, and materiality, where component evolutions produces variation through degrees of adaptive mutation in multiple loosely bound layers, and not within a single continuous surface. And I think this is what we're trying to say, is that this kind of idea and architecture of this, like, what people have talked about, this incredibly thin, hyper-engineered surface that does everything but has so much hyper-specificity that if one little thing changes, God knows what's going to happen, right? That in fact, our method should be much more systemic about binding together sort of less complex things in loose layers that can be reconfigured. And so at the basic level, it also has us recognize that hierarchy, in other words, organizing these things hierarchically, in other words, this is not a rhizome, right? Which is always a distinguishing feature of ecosystems, is a necessary organizational principle of an architectural ecologic. And then finally, we also want to realize that rather than imagining the intricacies of form, the intent here is to construct a system logic imbued with both formal and performative tendencies, while retaining enough malleability to escape the particularity of a single sort of instance. And I think that one of the weird things is it's this tension between intent, which is systematic, and available modes of representation like this image that explains sort of why the discipline of architecture has struggled to assimilate the idea that a project can be carefully designed yet resist a definitive tectonic formulation. And I think this is because it's very difficult to apply traditional ways of making architectural judgments, sort of like relative proportionality, compositional effect, all these things, about the relative merits of a particular design proposal that remains, even during the course of its occupied life, fairly fuzzy, right? And as this is sort of the difficult, I think difficult, interdisciplinary leap that we have to make when we start working with these kinds of systems, which is that if we are going to seize this territory made available to us by the interaction of computational potential and systems thinking and ecological modes of thought, we kind of have to expand our definition of beauty and acknowledge potentiality in systems. And we have to see value in systems that sort of we lose control of, and even outside of our direct control become something remarkable. So I think for us, what I'm trying to say is as architects, it's really hard for us to make an architectural judgment, which we do constantly every day, 5 seconds, 50 million times a day, even about every little detail of this building. It's very hard for us to somehow think about how we evaluate systems that we can't assign a real concrete formulation to, especially in the design process. And so that's sort of our like last little moment of insight about how we even begin to approach these kinds of things as architects.
Thank you.
At first, I was didn't know quite what to make of this, but several thoughts started running through my head, and I wonder if it's occurred to you the analogy of these structures that you are talking about to coral reefs. When they want to stimulate the growth of coral reefs, they sink old cars, concrete, sometimes they actually build structures out of metal, because it's simply the structure present, which attracts the organisms to the structure, and as the years go by, you do have the foundations of a new coral reef.
Right.
And I'm guessing that a structure like this, all you have to do is put a few plants on it, but it will attract, actually, biodiversity from the surrounding environment, perhaps.
Well, that was kind of an idea.
I had a very interesting idea.
Yeah, that was kind of the idea, and the sort of artificial coral reef is not something where it's something we are familiar with, but the idea of kind of setting up the basic system and kind of letting it grow, right, and this sort of idea of a variation that it's both between, that's hierarchically given, yet it has a lot of formal variation depending how does, let's say, COBE deals with sort of need for surface area, exclusion, inclusion, you know, kind of a matrix of the building which has certain input between that and between the sort of functionality of a system and notion of biodiversity. I think that it has a multiple set of controls, which eventually don't have a single formal agenda, but it have kind of systemic.
I may have missed this, but was the inspiration for this epiphytes or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that all our work has a similar inspiration. The sort of our office is called Epiphyte Lab. So the understanding of this way of working, it's kind of systemically within, I guess, everything we do, although this has kind of a specific variables.
I'm interested in the way you model certain things like the sun and the wind. And I'm interested in what you're not modeling. So I would just ask you the general question of how you deal with unintended consequences. Because I'm always fascinated by the kinds of things that happen that you never even thought of, you didn't model. And so it's sort of an impossible question. But I just wanted to get your thoughts about knowing that the world is filled with unintended consequences. How do you approach that question?
It's a wicked problem.
Wicked problem question. I think I think the idea is to make the systems flexible. We didn't show a lot of the details of how the system works, but you know, part of it is that the cable nets form the main structure, but they're pretty easy to sort of put down and take down and put up. And at the same time, the way that the other networks overlay them is very loose, so they're not tightly bound. So I think that our thought is that that we can't really anticipate these things, but that if the system is got this layered quality as opposed to this kind of particular construction, that hopefully people would be able to sort of adapt it. Now, the one piece of it that is a little bit less adaptable is how it hits the ground, because these things would need a fair amount of reinforcement. Interestingly enough, there's lots of concrete on the ground, too. It seems like the one thing that the sort of Czechoslovakian state could produce without any problem was enormous amounts of concrete, which they put everywhere. And also, we didn't mention it, but also the idea of using these gabions. So the gabions, the idea of the gabions is actually they're just all the bloody concrete that we want to take out and replace with sort of this sort of reconstructed kind of Danube edge is actually all just all the concrete that's already there on the site, right? And so the hope is that's the way that this would work. Now, would it really work that way? I mean, inevitably, there might be unintended consequences that we were incapable of foreseeing that would cause some sort of catastrophic failure. And that's sort of the intent of the modeling in things like sustain, which is kind of a first step but is fairly inadequate. Because in a way, we want to think of ways to model potential scenarios. But you know, at the end, it's like you try and build a flexible system, you try and run some scenarios, and yeah, there's always the possibility that you're going to be sort of completely wrong, right? I think one of the interesting questions is that as architects, we don't like to think about what happens if our building is going to go wrong, and if it does, we never want to tell anybody about it. So maybe the answer is that you have to think of it as kind of an experiment. And the idea is that you could also try it out on a piece. If it didn't work, then you would just only have like a little bit of it. But that if it did work, various other buildings and communities within this, I mean, this place is enormous, right, would start to adapt it as a kind of kit of parts.
But also, it's a problem of determinacy, right, at how you become so determinant to come up with a one-fixed solution. And I think that the reason why we take some of this more prevalent sort of analytical strategies and create hybrid out of them has to do with kind of a social and ecological context of the actual site. So there is an intentionality beyond the determinacy of the actual data. So there is no one-to-one relationship.
I just want to point out something which I found really interesting. Like, you clearly are investing a lot of energy in developing simulation models, but also in trying to visualize the results of these simulations. And maybe that's a really key aspect. No, there is one graphic you showed at some point where you sort of have this kind of nuanced space where you can kind of move and approach areas of different probabilities or potential of growth accordingly to how your simulation in fact are able to scan the environments, and I think maybe there is a kind of work that can be done in that direction, so that the simulations don't become merely a way of predicting what it could be, but actually could operate in real time as the project is installed and runs and evolves and become a kind of constant guidance, no, to decision taking. I mean, for you know, whoever is managing the project, but also for the people who are using it on a daily basis. So maybe there is a way in which kind of graphical and visual and different type of media can enable the users of the project to access the power of these simulations and make it much more operational. So, and rather than just having it, sorry, somebody decided to cut me off. Okay, and yes, sorry. But no, I mean, maybe you want to speculate a little more on that. I think it's a very interesting aspect that could be pushed further.
Well, I have a kind of thought about this in terms of simulation, which I kind of like the idea of buildings and environments being sensed and sort of simulated at the same in real time, at the same time they're being occupied, both to sort of as a way of seeing how these things diverge, like the simulation and the reality also diverge, but also as a kind of exactly that, as a kind of interactive method through which you can get these multiple sources of information as actually being in a project. So you have information from the occupation of a space, but then the integration of larger scale information into a visually sort of
comprehensive, some sort of format, navigable format, I think you're right, is super interesting. And I think that in the end, if we want to have these kind of reconfigurable buildings or buildings that have some capacity to evolve, we obviously have to have a feedback loop, because unlike an animal, which is going to evolve through natural selection and reproducing itself and kind of, you know, going through generations, our buildings kind of are one generation shots. And so any reconfiguration of a system like this is going to happen through the agency of people. They can only do that reconfiguration if they have some sort of like good sensibility of what the whole system looks like, potentially. So I think you're right. I think it's pretty, it's a pretty interesting idea.
One more question.
I have just two quick ones. You're probably familiar with the work of Frederick Hundertwasser. His buildings and art are pretty close in Vienna. That, and I wonder how much that might, his work might actually be related in some way to what you're thinking about. And then just really quickly, I was at lunch and left my copy of this in the lunch. And if anybody by any chance picked it up, I have some notes in it. So it would be great to get it. Thank you.
Hundertwasser.
Oh.
In influence or not? You went to school in Vienna.
Yeah, I did. I'm thinking. You know, I don't think that the there is sort of a direct relationship. I think that this idea of kind of simulated natural landscape, which he has been playing with, especially in his museum, where you walk on, I don't know if you've been in Vienna, but kind of using ceramic tiles and sort of more sort of art naive, creating these internal landscape of spaces which are non-orthogonal, right? So there's kind of a simulation of the natural geometry as you approach it with as a human. And it's definitely a strange experience to walk into the building, which is full of hills, and it's quite fascinating. I don't know to which extent it's any direct relationship, but any kind of a kind of accumulated experience from anyone's life probably gets out in a certain way. But I don't know what else to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that work is something that exists somewhere in a kind of visual memory that you have, or a systemic memory you have of how you think about architecture. Because when I was in school, this stuff was things that people were interested in. So I wouldn't say we were directly thinking about him so much. I mean, much more we've been looking at the work of people like Friato, Richard Burton, for example, stuff. Also looking at the work of the super studio kind of thing from the 1970s, I think is maybe more directly influential, but yeah, it's probably in the air somewhere.